All right. Well, I guess let's start with, take us back to the
Sorry,
beginning.
One second. Can you just straighten out your undershirt? There you go.
See, he's taking the place of your wife and daughter.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the camera guy. It's my job. make our subjects look good.
Well, you guys, your work cut out for you then.
All right. Take us back to how did Walleyes for Tomorrow start? What was the genesis of that?
Well, back in about 1985 to 89, Wisconsin had a drought going on. And Winnebago walleye population survives on spawning marsh reproduction up on the Fox and the Wolf River. And there wasn't any in those 5 years, 4 or 5 years. And some of the guys like myself that fished Winnebago a lot got the idea that, well, we need to do something if we can. To be able to ensure that walleyes have a place to spawn. So we got together, 12 of us, and decided we could have a banquet and raise some money, and we did that. And then we went to the DNR in Oshkosh and asked what we could do to help bolster the walleye population. And they had all kinds of ideas, all of which cost money. So we did the Eureka Dam project, which was to fill in the boil hole below the Eureka Dam. Gordy Priegel, who had been a biologist at Oshkosh in the late 60s and early 70s, had documented that every fry of every fish species that went over that dam died in the boil hole below it. So $154,000 later, we filled in that boil hole. It's now the Eureka Rapids. And we proceeded from there to do habitat work on the rivers. Marshes are normally dry. They're dry marshes 90% of the year, but in the springtime when the river gets up flood stage, females go in and spawn, but you have to have adequate water flow and consistent water flow for the eggs to have time to incubate, and then the little larvae get washed out. So we proceeded to right the wrongs of many generations of people. They built roads across the marshes. So we take out a small 12-inch culvert and put in 3 36-inch culverts to facilitate more water flow. So we did a lot of projects like that, and both on the Fox and the Wolf. And I think it's worked well. I mean, I go on the DNR trawler every year, and last year, now, the trawler's been running since 1986, and last year they caught the most adult walleyes. It's not designed to catch adult walleyes, and the most yearling walleyes they've caught since 1986. So the fish population on Winnebago is doing pretty well, and we like to take credit for it, right or wrong. But we've had some fantastic people be part of this organization that do great work, that really care about the resource, and that's been a big deal.
How do you convince a bunch of people that they should donate money or, you know, support an organization so they can fill in a hole in the river? I mean, how do you just teach, like, how do you explain to them, like, that's where you're literally throwing your money in a hole in the river?
Yeah, I never thought about it that way, but people understand the value. Like, I call them river rats. The river guys up on the Fox and the Wolf, they understand the value of these marshes. And we have been really blessed on this system with some of the best DNR biologists you'll ever want to meet. Going way back to Dan Foltz and Vern Hacker, that's back in I came here permanently in 72, and I met Vern Hacker, who was the rough fish removal coordinator. And those guys have just been fantastic in supporting what we do and telling the public what the public needs to know. And that's what it takes, is to educate the public so that they understand and know what is appropriate and necessary. And we've been really blessed with those kinds of people.
So you're doing a lot of infrastructure type projects.
Mm-hmm.
How did you grow beyond that in terms of the scope of what you were doing?
I can't say we ran out of places to work, because there still are more. We have not done many projects, I think only two, on state-owned land. Almost all of our projects have been on private property with a handshake. And nice thing about it, like at New London, Todd Close was our project manager. Todd lives on the river, and he knows a lot of people. And we pretty much ran out of places to do a lot of work. So we're paying for a lot of tagging studies and research. And because as global warming affects the environment, and it is affecting the environment because the water is warming up, we need to know what's necessary to do if we can do something. And that's really important.
So have you shifted more into, you talk about funding research, I mean, because you have to answer the questions before you can figure out what to do, right?
Right, yeah. And yeah, because right now we don't know what's coming. That's the big problem. We don't have a clue what, there's anecdotal evidence right now that, walleyes are cool water species, trout are cold water, and then the warm water species are bass, bluegill, crappies. The warm water species in a lot of walleye lakes are starting to supplant the walleye population. And what can you do? We don't know, but there are research projects going on to look at options, I guess is the best way to put it. And we've given the UW Stevens Point Foundation $300,000, and that's invested in their fund, and the proceeds from that goes to a graduate level research project every year to support I call them kids, the young people that are doing these types of studies. And they're under the supervision of Dr. Dan Iserman at Stevens Point, or Dr. Greg Sass at the Escanaba Research Station. And they're doing some really interesting studies. We'll see how it all pans out.
But when you get that, when you get those presentations back, because they come and speak to your group, right?
Yes.
So what is the reception in the room? What's the mood feel like when people hear that and they know, hey, I'm paying so I can learn more? Are they interested, or they're like, show me a big fish?
No, we're by and large a bunch of old guys. We've seen a lot of fish. So that's not a big deal. The big thing is they like to know that there's results coming from the money that's being raised. And that's a really big thing, because we've given money to some projects and we never hear the results. We've never been given the results, partially because we don't ask for them, which we probably should, but we haven't. But studies that are panning out positively, it's a great thing. We haven't really had any negative results yet, I guess, which is an even better thing. So there's still hope.
So at what point along the journey of this group, you shifted from some of the infrastructure to doing our research? Did the research go hand in hand with this understanding that the lakes are changing and that the habitat is changing?
The habitat's definitely changing, mainly because of us. Lake habitat has changed dramatically, and it's called carbon. The carbon content of many lakes all across northern Wisconsin and the whole northern part of the United States, there's a carbon deficit in a lot of lakes, and you have to have enough carbon present in the lake to support the vegetative growth that's in the lake. And people yank trees out of the water as soon as they fall in the water, those kinds of issues. The shorelines are developed, they use pesticides, herbicides, which may, and salt. Salt is a huge issue. Sodium chloride changes the water chemistry to a point that's really not even well understood yet. I've seen a couple presentations, they're getting there, and pretty soon, I don't know if you can do anything about it because people don't want snowy roads. The evidence is those kinds of issues are a real problem. And it's, like I said, with the culverts, 100 years ago when a person wanted to go across the marsh to access a farm field, or one bunch of culverts we replaced, they put them in to facilitate muskrats. back when there was a good market for furs. They wanted to hold water, but so humans are not always the best stewards of the ecology, let's put it that way.
And maybe part of knowing what to do is learning, you know, what's happened and how can we change it to be what we want it to be.
Yeah, and but quite frankly, we're kind of slow in accepting the effects of human decisions. And I'll go with fishing regulations. Walleyes are broadcast spawners. They just spawn along the shoreline, whereas bass, bluegill, crappies, and those fish, they're nest spawners. So when a little walleye hatches, they're on their own. But when a little tailed bass, for instance, when they hatch, the male sits there and protects them until they're ready to motor away from the spawning area. And we, DNR, and people of Wisconsin are accepting regulations that protect those fish until they have a chance to spawn several times, which may change the population. It has changed the population dynamics in some lakes. Slowly but surely, there are some lakes up in northern Wisconsin now where the bag limit is 5 a day for largemouth bass and no size limit. They're trying to reduce the number of bass. And some of those are study lakes. So, you know, it takes time to...
Well, how much of that does come down to the attitude of groups like yours and educating the people that do a lot of the fishing of like, hey, it may be great and exciting for you to have these bigger bag limits or, you know, to think that the slot limit's the way to go or no limit, size limit on parts of Winnebago, you know, but this is what the science says.
Yeah, well, there's other organizations that promote catch and release of those kinds of species. Don't eat them, turn everyone loose that you catch. Whereas we promoted a catch, kill, and eat tournament for bass, for largemouth bass. They taste fine if you prepare the flesh properly. But yeah, it's a cultural thing and an economic thing too. I mean, some organizations have a lot of money invested, like us, we have a lot of money invested in walleyes, in panfish species. So I wouldn't say it's a competition, but it's a definite, I don't know, cultural thing.
Well, what has that meant? I mean, obviously the largemouth competition with walleye in some northern lakes has been in favor of largemouth, especially with the warming climate. And there are a lot of bass fishermen that just want to go along the shoreline and cast and catch bass all day. They don't care if they get a walleye.
Sure. I grew up down south. I lived down south my entire life until I came to Wisconsin in 1972. And I caught a lot of bass and a lot of crappies down south. And I don't have anything against bass and crappies, but there is a, like I said, the regulations have been formulated that, in our opinion, favors those species over walleyes. And walleyes are a slow maturing fish. We paid for a study on Lake Winnebago. Ryan Koenigs looked at 3,000 dead female walleyes. And there's two big tournaments every year on Winnebago, the Merck National and Otter Street. And what he found was that 80% of the 5-year-old females had not spawned once. 80% of the 6-year-old females had spawned at least one time. So what female walleyes don't, you know, in this system, that's not the case in every system because every system is different. You cannot rubber stamp walleye habitat and walleye species or walleye population responses to their habitats. Dr. Ron Brook, who used to be our biologist here, he and his friends have caught 200 walleyes on the Flambeau River. And in a walleye's head, there's a what's called an otolith bone. And you can slice it, and you can stain it, and you can actually count growth rings. You can tell he found 14-inch walleyes on the Flambeau River that were 7 years old. Out here, a walleye reaches 14 inches in 2.5 years. It's all got to do with forage. And so you can't, that's the problem with it, with walleyes anyway, is habitat really dictates how walleyes exist and how they their success in everything they do.
So when did your group start getting into creating the hatcheries?
25 years. Well, we started in 91, and we built the first hatchery probably in 93 or 94. Gordy Priegel, who was the biologist at Oshkosh, he went from here to Fitchburg, and he built the hatchery in a Volkswagen bus. He was good. Just a few hatching jars, incubation cylinders, whatever you want to call them, and he was going to take it around for show and tells at schools, and we figured, well, if he can do that, we can do that. The big deal was getting a buy-on from the DNR. You have to have what's called a collection and reintroduction permit to catch the fish, strip the eggs, fertilize the eggs, and put them in your hatchery and turn them loose, which is fine. But again, we were lucky. The guys at Oshkosh were the ones that needed to give us those permits, and we ran our first hatchery on Little Green Lake over in Green Lake County. It was a disaster. But anyway, it hatched fish, but what we did, oh, we were ignorant. We ran the little fish that were hatching right off the end of the pier, and if you walked at the end of the pier, there was a whole school of bluegills sitting there getting lunch. So it's been an evolution. The hatcheries we have now are all alike as far as structure and function. That's been, like I said, an evolution. But they work. We know they work now. We, on Green Lake 2 years ago, the only way to definitively tell what comes out of our hatchery is to do a genetic fin clip. We fin clip the female that we use for the eggs, and we fin clip the male that we use for the sperm. And that pairing, well, we use a vial of alcohol and put each fin clip in a vial. And that goes to Stephen's point. We get 100 vials in a packet, and they run these through a very neat machine about the size of a big microwave. And the next morning, they genetically pair those two fish. So then in the fall of the year, when the department goes out and they do what's called a fall fingerling survey and shock looking for fall fingerlings, generally speaking, they're 5 to 7 inch long little walleyes. They do a fin clip and they send it to Point, and we can tell if it comes out of our hatchery. The Green Lake study, 74% of the fish that they clipped came out of our hatchery over there. So that is the definitive way. On Pewaukee Lake, when we started there, I think 11 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago now, the department had determined that there was one adult walleye, and an adult walleye, and from their perspective, is any walleye over 15 inches. The population was 0.17 per acre, which, you know, that's one fish every 5 acres, maybe six, one adult. We've been there 10 years, and the walleye population now is determined at 4 per acre. And the only thing that changed was we went in and put more predators in the water. We flipped the fish population there. When we first started working there, we used fike nets. They're a tubular net that's used to catch fish. The first day that we were there, we probably took 500 to 1,000 small yellow perch from 3 to 5 inches long out of that net. And they were sexually mature. That's another issue. Perch, little perch, they're sexually mature at 3 years old. And now they're gone because we put enough predators in there to reduce that population. And other fish species have responded. Whatever those little perch were eating competed with pumpkin seed. Pumpkin seed are a panfish. They now have 10-inch pumpkin seed in Pewaukee Lake. They had never seen that kind of it. But the predator-prey relationship shifted so that there was more for the pumpkin seed to eat. So these are the side issues, but there's the good issues that they're called anecdotal evidence, but, you know, we see it, and it's happened.
Well, walk me through a little bit of what we're going to see tonight when you release the fish and how you know when to do it, where to do it, to ensure to give them the best chance.
Sure. What we do now is the incubation jars are in the hatchery, and based upon what I just learned from Sean O, Ken Vandyplas up there, his average water temperature was 50 degrees over the course of 21 days, and his fish started hatching 21 days after he put them in with an average temperature of 50 degrees. That's book perfect. That's exactly what it says in the book, the Culture Walleye book, Culture Walleye and Sauger book. And so what we do is we keep the eggs in the hatchery, and as they hatch, we have a collection trough in the hatchery, and it goes outside, and we have six tanks out there that has a fry distribution manifold. We can valve off sections of this manifold, like what we did earlier this week. We just put the little guys in tank one because there weren't very many hatching. And then we put the next bunch in tank two because there still wasn't very many hatching. Yesterday, they started to really hatch because of warming water, and we're putting them in the third and fourth tank. And today, I shut those off, and I started putting them in the fifth and the sixth tank. We have to hold them. We don't have to, but it's more beneficial to hold them. When a little walleye exits the egg, it's actually considered a larvae. They don't have any scales, they don't have any fins, they don't have a mouth that's open, they don't have a swim bladder. I tell everybody that they've got a brain, two eyes, and a beating heart. that's about all there is to them. And but over the course of two days, we keep them 48 hours in our holding tanks. That gives them a chance to absorb the yolk sac, and they go from what's called swim up fry, and you'll see them today. They kind of swim up and then they sink, and they swim up and they're just absorbing their yolk sac as they develop parts of their body so they can actually swim. And then they become what's called horizontal swimmers. And when they become horizontal swimmers, after about 4 days and their mouth opens, they need something to eat. So we turn them loose after 48 hours because they're horizontal swimmers and they can motor around and find. So that's what you'll see today. We have those that we caught 2 days ago. They're in one tank, and we drain the tank down using a siphon in a filter, so we don't siphon them onto the ground, and consolidate them. Then we put them in coolers, and we take them right out in the middle of the lake. And we know from past experience, we buy zooplankton toes. It's a net that you tow behind the boat, and you can judge where the zooplankton. Zooplankton are microscopic or macroscopic aquatic organisms that these little fish eat. And so we take them out in the middle of the lake and turn them loose. And they're on their own. But we try to give them a good place for their first meal anyway. And there aren't the predators out there that's wanting to eat a little walleye that's less than a quarter of an inch long. So, nothing we can do about it.
It works, right?
Yeah. We tell people, we don't try to give people too big of an expectation. We tell people, if we get 0.5% of what we produce makes it to 15 inches, we're probably doing pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, break some of those numbers down for me, because you're talking how many eggs, fertilized eggs, are you actually putting in your jars?
Millions. Sean O this year had 11 million. Green Lake right now has got 7 million. We had almost 5 million at Pewaukee, or at Big Cedar. Pewaukee had 6 million. And we use 4 million. 4 million used to be our goal. Everybody likes bigger goals. So, but we always used to tell people, if we can put 4 million little fish in a lake, what I didn't say is we can't move these little fish around. Where we take the eggs from, the little fish have to go back in that body of water. A lot of reasons. But we used to tell people, if we put 4 million in, 0.5% of 4 million is 20,000. It's just a numbers game. If we can put enough in to offset natural mortality and predation. Hopefully we'll get some kind of a net, and we do in most cases.
So why walleye?
That's a good question. I never caught a walleye until I was 22 years old, so never even saw one. But they're the preferred fish. Everybody says panfish are the preferred fish, but really, I was down on the Little Cedar today, and there was a guy at the boat landing, and I said, "You catch anything?" He says, "Nope, haven't got a walleye yet." So there you go. I mean, there's whatever there is in Little Cedar that he might catch, but the first thing he said was, "Haven't caught a walleye yet."
When did that take place, where walleye became like the definitive ideal fish in Wisconsin?
Tournaments. Yeah, the first walleye weekend tournament was at Oshkosh in about 1980, and now it's, well, they just had their 50th here in Fond du Lac, so it must have been in 82. And tournament fishing really, and you know, the boat manufacturers and the motor manufacturers, they push selling their products, and a good way to do it is have people come to tournaments and have people come in, and it's an event. 70,000 people will go to walleye weekend here on a weekend. And it's not only walleyes anymore. I mean, when they first started the festival part, now it's called Fond du Lac Festivals, the festival part wasn't near what it is now. But tournament fishing, yeah, that really made a difference in walleye fishing.
But I mean, the history of walleye, like the there was the Friday night perch fish fry when they were commercially caught in Lake Michigan,
right.
But the walleye was still, for a lot of people, that was the definitive like Friday night fish food.
They taste good, that's one thing. Fish taste is totally dependent upon fat. Fish fat has an objectionable flavor to most people. That a lot of people call it the mud line on the side of a fish. That's brown fat, it's not a mud line. And it has a fish taste, and a sometimes very strong fish taste. Perch and walleye have a very, very low intermuscular fat content, so they taste good.
And most people probably don't even think of it that way.
Nope. People left Chicago back in the 20s to drive to Boulder Junction, take them 3 days to get there to go walleye fishing in Wisconsin. So it's always been an allure, you know. People like to fish.
And there would be a significant loss if there weren't walleye available to be caught.
Well, walleye and all other other species, walleye's for tomorrow. Must be almost close to 20 years ago, we funded a fishing economic value study on Lake Winnebago. Matt, can't think of Matt's last name. He's an economist at UW-Whitewater, and Dr. John Stoll at UW-Green Bay. They looked at the value of fishing, just fishing alone on Winnebago to the four counties around the lake. And like I said, that's probably close to 20 years ago. It was $143 million, and it supported 4,500 people's employment. Fishing is big business. In Wisconsin, it's well over $1 billion a year industry. And so we like to be part of it, I guess. Not for that reason, but.
But I mean, that is part, I mean, there's the bait store. There's people that make the rod. The boat motors, they make the boats, the restaurants, the hotels, the resorts, the campgrounds, and you know, every aspect.
Oh yeah, well, tourism in Wisconsin is a huge industry, and hunting and fishing are huge parts of it. I mean, people like to go camping, people like to boat, but And as you, we were talking about earlier, you guys were at a tournament yesterday. The value of fishing equipment has exponentially increased. When we fished the second walleye weekend here in Winnebago, people were fishing with wooden boats and canoes and bass boats and every kind of craft you can imagine. And now when they leave the harbor, if there's a boat valued at less than $55,000 or $60,000, he's on the low end of the totem pole. I mean, there's boats out there that are over $100,000 easy. And fishing is big business.
How do people, I mean, I'm sure there's some of your members own those boats.
Oh yeah.
They're in those things. Do you ever ask them? It's like, is that just purely enjoyment? I mean, is that how they justify it? Or, because that's more than a vehicle. Some people, that was probably what they bought their homes for back in the day.
Me.
That's a ton of money.
Yeah. And I always used to say it's expendable income, but that's not true. I mean, I know some young people that really go deep in debt to buy a nice big boat. It's a status symbol. With the group they hang out with, a big boat's what counts. And I run a 20-foot Warrior that's 20 years old. Still floats, and I can still catch fish out of it. You know?
Well, just, yeah, we were in a boat, and they were flipping through tackle boxes.
Oh.
They said each lure is $11.
Now they are.
And just...
it's nuts.
Hundreds of them in there.
Yeah. Yeah, the cost of fishing equipment has gone up exponentially as well. People will pay it.
But there's still access for people who don't have that kind of money,
sure.
Right? I mean, it's not just for wealthy, upper middle class.
Leeching a night crawler on the end of a hook with a slip bobber will catch walleyes. Yeah, sure.
I mean, you don't have to drive around too much. There's people hanging out at bridges and
yep.
Shorelines. And
sure. Go right out here. One of the things that we haven't talked, when we started Walleyes for Tomorrow, we were talking to a... come on, it's my wife. When...
she heard what you were wearing.
Yeah. I told her I wouldn't be home till 6:30. I don't know what she wants now. But anyway, when we started Walleyes for Tomorrow, we were talking to a professor at UW-Stevens Point, and we talked about all the things we want to do on the Winnebago system. And he said, you know, if you guys are really good at what you do, you may be forage for tomorrow. Because if you produce all these walleyes, they need something to eat. So one of the things that we did besides the spawning habitat is on Winnebago, we started putting rocks in the water, building rock piles. Not for spawning, walleyes don't spawn, well, I don't say not, I don't, we don't think they spawn out in that deeper water on those rock piles. But everything else lives on them, snails and crayfish and aquatic insects and other fish, which walleyes need for forage. And we have 150 rock piles around the shoreline of Winnebago, from up by Wentz all the way around to Stockbridge. And that's one of the things that an event. At that time we were hauling the rocks out on the ice, and we had the East Shore crew and the Finelac crew and the West Shore crew each doing their own thing, cutting holes in the ice so the trucks could come and drop the ice, rocks through the ice. Brian Noble, I don't know if you remember, he was a Packers.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, when he retired, he became an outdoor person for one of the TV stations in Green Bay. He came down and videoed us dumping rock. I mean, what's so exciting about dumping rock through the ice? But that's part of the reason why we are what we are. We did things, and like if you're part of DU, you never do anything for DU. You go to a DU banquet and assume they spend money. We don't do that. every one of our, we have 9 hatcheries running this year, and every one of our hatcheries is run by a dedicated bunch of people at each of the sites where the hatcheries are located, and that's huge. You get the local people that can come, they can come and look at what's going on in the hatchery, but they can also be part of it. And local support is huge when it comes to local activities.
Well, just at the Big Cedar one, like we saw the kids there.
Mm.
I mean, what does it mean to you when you see a couple of young girls just as excited as the guys to be netting those fish?
I'm prejudiced. I have a wife and 2 daughters and a granddaughter. So yeah, I love having young girls come in and help. You know, everybody thinks fishing is a guy sport, but my granddaughter, she was a wicked perch fisherman until she decided to pay attention to other things. But anyway, I've always thought that was the best part of what we do. We used to be at Big Cedar one year and Pike Lake the next year. We did that back and forth for 6 years. And on Pike Lake especially, I mean, there'd be 20 kids there watching us do our thing. And from me to you, well, across the table, I'd be stripping the eggs and the kids would be right there. It can't get any better. And at Pewaukee, I know 2 of the kids that had been, that were real active at Pewaukee went to Point and studied. I'm not sure exactly what they studied. One became a biologist, I think the other became had something to do with water. But anyway, it, direct relationship to having worked with our hatchery. And it's a good thing from the standpoint that you can get, it doesn't, there's no challenge to it, and there's no necessity for them to do anything other than come watch. And they can actually see these little fish swimming around. Better story I have to tell about that is at Pike Lake, I was stripping eggs one day, and there was a lady, and I'm old now, but this is a lot of years ago. I was probably 40 at that time. She had to have been 80. She stood across the table and watched me for at least a half an hour. Never said a word. And then once we started putting the eggs in the hatchery, she went in the hatchery and she watched the eggs roll for about a half hour, never said a word, walked away, and she never came back. But I told some of the guys that were here, I said, you know, that's what we're all about. That lady is 80 years old and she never had the opportunity to see something like that ever before. It's right in her backyard. She walked home. And it can't get any better.
Well, when you think of the title, Walleyes for Tomorrow, who's that tomorrow?
Yeah.
Who represents the tomorrow in your title?
Yeah, all the kids. All the young people that come. I call you a kid now. But anyway, all the young people that come to help us. And we are lucky. We get a lot of, and you know, kids listen. And they do what you tell them to do. Sometimes adults, they just don't listen. And no matter how many times you tell them, but most kids, you only have to tell them once and they get it. And they'll do what you ask them to do. And I love having kids come.
Well, the name itself is interesting because, you know, tomorrow's tomorrow, but you're talking years before someone might catch one of these fish.
Well, we stole the name, kind of. There's a group here called Sturgeon for Tomorrow, and they're really for tomorrow, you know, because the sturgeon doesn't get sexually mature till they're 20, the males till they're 20 years old. So they're out of brother town. And when we started thinking about a name, we kind of stole their name. Just, we can have a walleye for tomorrow too, you know. But no, and that's, you can talk all you want, but when you do something that people can actually see and understand that you're doing something positive, that's what counts. I mean, politicians sit wherever and talk and talk and talk and talk, but it's only the politicians that really get involved and do have activities that really affect the public in a positive way that count. And that's what we're all about. We're trying to do something that counts, and will be there for a walleye may live 20 years. The oldest walleye they've ever caught on Winnebago is 20 years old, and they know that. There's a population of walleye in Quebec that they don't get sexually mature until they're 15. Different living conditions, you know. So, yeah, it's for tomorrow.
You're talking about politicians, and obviously, you know, this doesn't super political, but at the same time, like Governor Walker had his walleye initiative. You know, did that do anything, or
no.
Was he trying to capitalize on the goodwill that people had towards walleye?
They have not released the results of the walleye initiative because it's been a disastrous failure. Pond-raised walleyes don't contribute to any substantial degree to the betterment of walleye populations. We've seen a lot of things with what we do with walleyes. And now, just this year, Ken Bandypaws up at Shawano had 3 hatching jars that didn't do well. And as an afterthought, he said, you know, he said, I think a lot of those females that we used during that period of time were some fin clip females. And the fin clip females are ones that the DNR has stocked. And so next year he's going to segregate and try to keep track. But I've been to 2 presentations now where early results for the stocking initiative is they only get 5 to 15% survival. And if you're stocking a fish that costs you $2 to raise and turn loose, when you start running the numbers from a pure economic standpoint, it makes no sense whatsoever. These fish are, people don't understand how absolutely complicated a fish is. We don't have a clue. We don't live underwater. We don't live in their environment. I even had a guy, we were talking, and he said, what do you think fish think? And I said, I don't have a clue. Because they don't think like us. They live in a totally different environment. But fish are a really, really complicated. I mean, the little bit we have done, we've learned so much about what you should and shouldn't do to fish, otherwise you kill them. But just water pH. When we're stocking the little guys, people use well water. pH 7 is neutral. 0.2 is not just 2/10 more acid or basic. It's 2,000 times more acid or basic. It's an exponential figure, and you can kill little fish just by not using the right water that you dump them into. That's why. We use ambient conditions. We don't heat the water. We don't do anything to the water. It comes in, goes through our hatchery, and goes right back out. People have tried heating water. People have tried to using wells, and they get too much iron in their water from the wells, and have disastrous results. So fish are, they're tougher nails, but they're really pretty sensitive in a lot of ways.
So if you... Would you, even if you had the money and the option to try and raise these eggs to fingerlings in a pond and then introduce them, you'd still probably do it the way you do it now?
Sure, it's more fun. No. We did raise some fish in a pond. Over at Green Lake, the hatchery is on a very, very, very old fish hatchery that was a DNR hatchery. It's got a 2/10 of an acre pond. So one year, we're going to raise some fish. It's a process. You have to drain the pond. You plant rye in the pond. You let the rye get up, then you flood the pond so it kills the rye. So the bacteria starts working on the decaying vegetation, and you throw corn or peanut meal or cottonseed meal in to help the zooplankton grow even more. Then you put the little guys in there, and they eat zooplankton. First, you go to the sewage treatment plant and you get a bucket of their mix that takes care of the nutrients in sewage. You put that in there, and that's what these little walleyes eat. And but then I tell people they like to go from the salad bar to the meat menu, and you have to feed them. We were feeding them a 96-quart cooler full of pinhead minnows. They're only a half inch long every 3 days. And luckily, we got them for free. If you had to buy them, the cost would be horrific. So we raised them till in that pond until, I think they took them out in June, late June, and got many thousand little one and a half inch walleyes. And then didn't get them all out, so then we threw 20 pounds of fathead minnows in the pond and took them out, I think, in September and got like 2,500 5-inch walleyes. But let me tell you, it's work. It's a job. And what we do now is work. That's Ken Bandyplas last year guesstimated he had 840 man hours tied up in running his hatchery. And that was with a 19-jar hatchery. This year he's got a 32-jar hatchery. He's nuts. I don't know why he does it.
Well, what does he say about you? I mean, how many hours do you spend every spring? I mean, do you even get to go fishing in the spring?
No. This is 7 days a week. Yeah. This time of year, I used to say it was my advocation, now it's my vocation. I just do it. I love working with fish. I mean, fish are really interesting creatures. And what I love more is when people come up and I can tell them what we're doing and show them what we're producing. This morning I had a guy down at Big Cedar, I don't know who he was, just a guy who drove up in a truck and wanted to see what we were doing. And I went through my whole spiel, got it memorized kind of. But people really appreciate what you do. And like I said before, you'll never be remembered for what you say, but you'll be remembered for what you do. I guess that's my basic philosophy.
For you, the walleyes for tomorrow is literal. What are you going to do tomorrow? More walleye stuff.
Yep. I'll be back down there in the morning.
So is there an off time? Like once they're all out in the lake, do you get a break then?
Oh, yeah. I'm going trout fishing.
not walleye?
Nope. I love to trout fish. And I've been trout fishing the same trout stream by Red Granite for 40 years. And that's my solitude time, just wading the trout streams.
And so why isn't this trout for tomorrow?
You're already a TU. And a good friend of mine is really in a TU. I mean, that's what he does, is TU and many other things. But anyway, no. And, you know, my mother-in-law never fished, ever. And back when I was working, I would fish Thursday afternoon, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and go back to work on Monday. And she said, why do you do that? And I said, because when I'm fishing, the only thing that's important to me is whether that bobber is on top of the water or under the water. Otherwise, I don't have a care in the world. That's why a lot of people do it. I mean, the tournament guys, that's a whole day. I did that. It's work. I enjoyed it. I enjoy this more.
So when it comes to relationships and walleye fishing, I mean, how many of these guys are married to the lake?
A bunch. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you met one of them, Tom Walters. I mean, and not only to the lake, he's married to that boat. Tom, hell of a nice guy. And he fishes a lot. And he's not unique. I mean, there's guys that fish 5 days a week if they can get out there. Weather is about the only thing that really puts a crimp in their activities.
I mean, have you known people that got divorced over the amount of fishing they've done?
I don't think so. Not that I know of.
Not that they've admitted.
Yeah. I'm really lucky. The person I married, she is totally supportive of what I do, even though my to-do list gets longer and longer and longer. She never grumbles. I called her today, and I planned to go to Big Cedar this morning early, do what I need to do, come home. And I called her and said, hey, I got to do an interview with Wisconsin Public Radio, and I got to go back to Big Cedar and be there at 5 o'clock. I won't be home till 6:30. Okay. She's used to it, which is fine. I mean, we get along great. She's a very nice person.
I'm sure others don't have it quite as lucky.
Nope, that's a fact. Tongue in cheek, I tell everybody, when I got my marriage license, I got my fishing license to go along with it. Because down south, I didn't hunt that much. It's a different culture down south as far as hunting goes. People think what they can think about Wisconsin. I live in Wisconsin because it's Wisconsin. My dad was in the Air Force. I lived in 7 different states before I was 20 years old. I lived in Maine. I lived in Puerto Rico. I lived in Oklahoma. Lived a lot of places. But when I came to Wisconsin in 1967, Wisconsin's a good place to be. That's why I'm here. My mom, I was born in North Carolina, and when my dad retired from the Air Force, they went back to North Carolina, and my mom always said, when are you coming back to God's country? And I said, Mom, I'm not leaving. I can go 40 miles in Fish Lake, Michigan. I can go 40 miles in trout fish. I can go 5 miles in walleye fish. Wisconsin's a good state, no matter how you cut it.
So when people think about walleye fishing, they probably are thinking very narrowly in terms of where they get to fish and their next opportunity. But do you think people realize all the ways that walleye go through every little aspect of the state, every corner of the state, whether it's through real estate and homes up north or a river property or, you know, the commercial or the bait shops or the guys who get the bait, they give to the bait shops, and, you know, the amount of tourism money, and then this research that all funnels back into it, and then the volunteer hours, and just, it seems like the more you look at it, the more it just spreads everywhere.
Yeah. Unfortunately, politicians sure don't see it that way, because they haven't chosen to support fishing in the state of Wisconsin like it should have been supported for many years. It's a huge industry. I mean, like I said, fishing alone is $1.5 billion industry in Wisconsin. I'm gonna turn the damn thing off. This is my life. I get a whole bunch of phone calls every day. Fishing is a, I don't know, politically, we were told, okay, the guy that I said is part of heavy duty in the Tar Unlimited, he was trying to talk to a legislator once about the necessity for a license fee increase, and that legislator says, there's more of them than there is you. That's why we don't worry about you. He was talking about the people that were lobbying for better funding for the resource. And it's really unfortunate. There are states that have been much more progressive. State of Minnesota and Missouri are two big ones. Minnesota has a 1/8 of 1% of their sales tax goes to support conservation efforts in the state of Minnesota. And Minnesota is a fantastic place to fish. And Missouri is the same way. There are, in Wisconsin, the legislature considers, they abhor taxes. And I could go into that for a long way. But it's ridiculous. I mean, People will pay, I was just a big cedar, $10 to launch your boat there. But they don't consider that a tax, that's a fee. It's the same money, just how what you consider it. And it's ridiculous. Of course, they have their priorities. We have ours.
What would be the most beneficial thing that politicians could do if they actually started listening?
Listen. They don't listen. They do listen, but they listen to the wrong people. They listen to lobbyists who sell one opinion or one type of opinion based upon who wants to pay them the most money. They need to listen to the public, and they don't. Even, like I said, that one guy told Bob, there's more of them than there is you. I don't have to listen to you because all they want to do is get reelected. And that's the big issue. We were lucky. Our chapter chairman in Berlin personally knows the state senator. She was a state representative, and now she's a state senator, Joan Baldwin. We needed to redo the Princeton Dam. It didn't have a fishway around it. That's the last dam on the Fox River that didn't have a fishway to get around it, for fish to get around the dam. And she was on the Joint Finance Committee. So George and I went to a Joint Finance Committee meeting in Berlin and gave him our spiel. And it cost $1.2 million to renew the dam there. And we went down to talk to Joan in Madison. And it got funded. Let's just put it that way, which is a good thing. And it seems that you have to handpick your supporters, which is unfortunate, because everybody, not everybody, they sell 1.2 million fishing licenses every year in the state of Wisconsin. There's only 5 million people in the state, and half of them, not half, but a proportion of them aren't old enough to buy licenses to begin with. And so fishing is a big deal. And they choose to have other topics that they rather discuss rather than that.
If the legislature was more active and supportive, would groups like yours still exist? Or are you filling a vacuum created by...
Sure. Yeah. And we're lucky because the public supports us. You have the Turkey Federation, Whitetails, you have DU, you've got Walleyes, you've got Sturgeon for Tomorrow. You got Wings Over Wisconsin. You got WWA, Wisconsin Waterfowl Association. The people understand that it takes money to support what they enjoy doing. I don't understand why the legislature doesn't understand that. But they can abscond from doing anything, and it just keeps right on sliding by. And not well. Because we're hurting right now, big time, for a lot of reasons. But the problem with legislators, they're not us. They're not outdoor people. Some of them may be. I can't speak for all of them, but they're really not us. You don't hear of any legislators that are ardent fishermen or ardent hunters.
It's because those guys are all too busy fishing. They couldn't imagine door knocking.
Sure. But I don't get that, because outdoor people vote. And a good way to, like Sportsman for Walker, I could never figure that out. Scott Walker was not a sportsman. And I don't understand why that even popped up, other than it was a good spiel. I mean, he didn't do us any favors. So why vote for a politician that doesn't do you any favors? course, everybody's got their own favors, so, you know. I don't want to get too off the wall in politics, but I could.
So I think we've covered quite a bit of ground here. Is there anything else that we should know?
Basically, yeah, if something isn't done for funding in the state of Wisconsin to support the natural resources in the state of Wisconsin by virtue of money, it takes money to manage the resource. I won't say we're going to turn into a third-rate place for people to come to, but we always talk about the tourist industry doesn't want our license to be increased because they feel it's going to, you know, affect tourism in the state of Wisconsin. But, you know, if you don't have fish, people aren't going to come. People don't go up north just to see the trees. They go up north to fish to a good degree. I mean, you go up I-39 on the weekend and there's boats going north all the time, and a lot of them are from Illinois. I don't understand why it should be a divisive issue. It just doesn't seem right.
We should each be able to afford an extra $10 for a license, right?
Got that right. You saw it. I tell everybody, the guy that hooked his $70,000 truck up to his $100,000 boat, and you fish with one of them, and goes to Erie for a week, they have no bitch for a $10 license fee. $100,000 boat fishing Winnebago for a weekend just burned $200 worth of gas, easy. So what's $10?
They spent more than that on gas tax.
That's right. And that's another issue. we get screwed. Boating gas tax is based on a boat is based upon the number of boats. There's a rebate, you know, because it's not highway tax, it's used on the water. So there's a rebate to the natural resources account from gas tax money. But it's based upon a boat using 50 gallons of gas a year. Some of those boats burn 50 gallons in a day. So we're getting screwed when it comes to taxes, the tax rebate, big time.
Yeah, because some of them fill up at a tank in town, and some of them fill up at a harbor or
wherever,
someplace on the lake, and yeah.
Wherever. I mean, most people go to Fleet Farm, 4 cents off on a gallon, and usually they're the cheapest place in town. Most of the time. But anyway, and all those big boats all burn premium now. You don't want to burn regular gas, so you're paying $3.89 a gallon. And I don't know how much taxes on one of those, but nevertheless, my boat's got a 35-gallon gas tank in it, so I'm blowing that 50 gallons a year issue away every two trips I make. It should be changed big time.
Yeah, you don't even get to fish in the spring.
Yeah, right. Oh, I could go fishing if I wanted to, but I have things to do. Crappies aren't spawning yet.
Yeah, you got to get pipes for your next.
Yeah, crappies aren't spawning yet.
All right, I think we're good here. Thank you for giving us time. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Let's just do like 30 seconds of room tone.
Sure. So we're just gonna listen to the sound of the room for a half minute or so. It's an old editing trick. So we'll just sit here awkwardly in silence. See if your phone goes off.